The paper boy's dog, being this big brindle Great Dane, the dog was almost as tall as the boy on the bicycle. Really a beautiful big dog. And my dog Jerry couldn't stand the idea of him going by there, so he went charging out from under the porch across the lawn and took a lunge at the dog. And the Great Dane just arched his neck, and when Jerry went flying through the air, missing the neck, why, he just reached down and grabbed him, grabbed Jerry by the back, in the small of his back, and just shook him like a rag doll and let him let loose and threw him over on the lawn. And of course he came howling back under the porch, and the paper boy just waved and went on. There was not much you could do. And so I finally got him coaxed out from under the porch, and where the dog had the Great Dane had caught him and shook him, it had ripped the skin open on his back. So we had to take him to the vet and got him sewed up, and it got along okay. But whenever the paper boy went by with that dog anymore, he stayed under the porch. He wasn't quite as aggressive as he had been. He was not a real aggressive dog by nature, and it was a surprise almost for him to do that. And the only time that I ever saw him ever be aggressive other than that was one time, and I think when we lived on 12th Street, the neighbor didn't like the dog. And so if our dog went over and got into his flower beds or anything like that, he would come out with a rake or a hoe and try to hit the dog to get him out of the yard. And I think he built up an aversion then for somebody striking him. Because one time when we were out on one of the scout outings, I took the dog with me, and because we were going on the scout hike, and we were all sitting around over by the churchyard waiting until it was time to go, and the dog was laying by me, and just a little ways away one of the boys just started tapping on the ground with a stick, not meaning to hit anybody, but just pounding the ground with a stick. And I heard Jerry start to growl, so I turned to the boy and I says, my dog doesn't like that, so you better not hit the ground anymore. And as boys that age will be, he says, well, I'll hit the ground if I want to. And he then took a big swing onto the ground and a little more toward the dog, and before I could grab Jerry, why, he was in the air and lit on the boy. But luckily I was went with him almost as fast, and I grabbed him and held him off, so he didn't hurt the boy or anything. He just scared him. But that's about the only time I ever remember him being aggressive. He was a very calm and very pleasant dog. Would play with kids. We would ride him. We'd pull on his nose. We'd do anything, and he would never cause any problem. He was a great hunting dog in the field. Dad would take my brother and I with him very often when he would go out hunting pheasants and or ducks. And we got many chances to watch the dog work beautifully. He would work a field and put the pheasants on point and hold them until Dad would walk in and flush them. Another little interesting thing happened with him one time when we were out duck hunting. I guess this to me kind of made a point that they always said that animals worked strictly on instinct, that they had no power of reasoning or thought or anything on their own. But we were duck hunting, and it, as usual, the duck hunting came in the late fall, and so it would be pretty cold lots of times, and we were out on where there was a big pond and waiting for the ducks to come in. And And they did, and Dad shot two of the ducks, and they both fell in the water, and the water was cold enough that it was around the edges, it was starting to freeze into ice. And so Dad sent Jerry after the ducks. He went in the water, and the duck had fallen far enough away that it was about halfway out. So he swam out and got the first duck and brought it back, and the other duck was even farther across the pond. So he went back for the second duck. Dad sent him out, and he went after the second one, and he was closer to the far shore than he was to where we were. And he picked up the duck and went on across the, swam across the pond and out on the far shore. And then he turned and looked both ways up and down the pond, and about a quarter of a block from where we were, there was a flume, which is a way that could transport water without it being down in the ground in a canal. They would build these flumes that were like little channels up on wooden pedestals. And this flume went across the pond, like I say, about a quarter of a block from us. Jerry looked both ways, then picked up the duck, ran to the flume, crossed on the flume, and back and up to where we were and dropped the duck at Dad's feet. Well, always through the years after that, I would say, don't tell me that a dog doesn't think. He didn't want to swim back through that icy cold water, so he went back up around and crossed on the bridge instead of swimming through the ice water. That was, again, something that I recall in my memory of a time when we were out with real great experiences with my father. My brother and I both enjoyed going with him when he would go fishing or hunting, and he would take us along, and we were so young, we didn't ever carry a gun or anything. We did have fishing poles and would fish with him when he'd fish, but we didn't carry the gun. One other time when we were out with him, he was after pheasants again, and we had hiked two or three fields with him, and it wore us out. So the next time he went to go out, which was just about at dusk, he stopped at one more field and took the dog, and my brother and I decided we'd stay in the car, and so we did, and he went out to hunt for pheasants. And he was gone quite a little while, and it began to get a little bit dark, and we were probably in around 8 and 10 years old. So that was, as it began to get dark, it was a little scary for us. We were through playing, and we were tired. And so we looked around. We couldn't see him anywhere. And so the two of us decided that what we should do is we should get down on our knees and pray for Dad to come back, because we were getting worried and we didn't know where he was or if he'd be coming back. And so that's what we did. At that age, we, on our own, made that decision. We got down on our knees and we prayed and asked that the Lord would help him find his way back to the car and get there real fast. And we had hardly stood up from the praying, and we heard Dad's whistle, which was his signal always to us, and he was about halfway through the field on his way back to us. And so we really felt that our prayers were answered. We were very naive and very young, but we did have that faith instilled in us by Mother and Dad when we were very young, and we felt that that the Lord had answered our prayers, and we were real grateful for that. As I say, I went through grade school there in Boise, and then the year that we moved out on 17th Street was the year I think I started high school. No, it wasn't. We moved on to 14th Street first, And it was while we were living, we were still renting a place, and we lived on 14th Street. That was before we had gone out, before the folks had purchased the house. And that was quite close to the high school, and that's when I started high school. I also had that little dance band going, and we had played for dances almost all that summer. And someone from the school heard about the band, so they invited us to play at the opening assembly when school started. They had a big opening assembly when they would have entertainment. They would also have the different teachers and school administrators talk to the students and so on for the start of the school year, especially for us who were freshmen, that was our first year into school. So we got our band together, I did, and we played for the at that opening assembly. And in the school yearbook for that year, there's a write-up in there that told about this band that Lumen Green had, that they were very impressed with and looked forward to hearing a lot more from them during the year. Well, we stayed together as a band during that year and did play for quite a few more occasions and dances. And but then through that summer, and that's the summer that we moved out on the 17th. I had missed that one in between when I started high school, but while I was in my first year, then toward the end of the year is when the folks purchased this house, and we were out there for about 1 year, and then Dad got transferred again with Metropolitan Life. At the time, I didn't really realize particularly why he was transferred, but I found out later, as I was old enough to understand and realize what had gone on, was that the manager of the office in Boise had brought in his son and was training him into the position to be vice president of the office, or assistant manager, and that was Dad's position. And so he offered Dad to stay on, but Dad says there's no way he could stay in that kind of position and have this young boy literally take over and be his boss. And so there had been a real good friend of his in the company who ran the district in Ogden area in Utah, and frequently he had said to Dad, well, you come down any time, I'll have an opening for you and would love to have you come and work with me in Ogden. So Dad got in touch with him, and he says, well, I don't have an opening in Ogden right now, but I have an opening in Brigham City, which is a little town about 20 miles from Ogden. And he said, if you'll come and take that position in Brigham City, then as soon as I get an opening in Ogden, we'll move you right in. So we moved from Boise to Brigham City, and we moved in October of 1935, which was the year that I had been the freshman, 34 and 35, and so I started as a sophomore at the Boise High School and in September, and went September and part of October, and then moved to Brigham City and was in as a sophomore in Brigham City High School in the rest of my sophomore year, the last part of it, and my junior year in high school. That's how long we stayed there. When we went to Brigham City, again, the folks rented a place, and they rented an apartment. It was in the Barron Apartments that were quite nice. They were really a very, very nice units. And they were right adjacent to the Barron Woolen Mills, which the company, the family that owned the apartments also owned this, the woolen mills where they took the yarn and made woolen clothing. It was a very nice line of clothing and very popular, and they were quite wealthy people. And we lived in their apartments for the first year we were there. But it was a little crowded. It was a little small because of the they were apartments. There was only the three of us at home, mother and dad, and then the three of us children, Mary and me and my brother Carlisle. Leola and Maud had both gone away to school and also were near to getting married at that time. And just a couple of experiences that were kind of interesting while we were there in the Barron apartments. Let me digress a little and I'll go back. One of the things I did while in Boise to earn money, and I started the first time to do this when I was 9 years old. In those days, when the newspapers would come out in late afternoon, there was what they called the boy sales, and boys would go, or girls could go, and buy newspapers right from the newspaper office, and we'd buy them for 3 cents a piece, and then we would go and stand on a street corner in a business district area and try to sell those newspapers to the people as they walked by, as they got off work or so on. And there wasn't near as much home delivery on newspapers at that time as there was later on, but there was some in the outlying areas. But a lot of the people just bought their newspaper when they'd get off from work. So the first job I ever had was selling newspapers, and I would go and buy the newspapers for 3 cents and stand on the corner and sell them for 5 cents. So I'd make 2 cents out of every paper. So if I could sell 10 to 15, 20 papers each afternoon that I would go there to work, why, I made pretty big money. I can make anywhere from 10 to 20 cents, which was real big, because prices, to give you a comparison on them, we could go to a movie for 10 cents, and we could buy a cold drink, a root beer or something, for 5 cents. You could buy a big bag of popcorn for 5 cents. So for 20 cents, you could go on a Saturday afternoon, and they had the Saturday afternoon matinees had a whole series of movies. It wasn't just one movie repeated over and over. They would have some cartoons, and then they would have a serial, which was a like the soaps or the cereal programs that they have today on them, and they were adventure type deals. They were the type where each week the hero and all of the people would have this little story go on, and at the end of the thing, why, he would end up in some precarious position that looked like he might lose his life or something serious happened to him. And that's the way it would end, so you had to go back the next week to see how he came out, to see if he was successful. And of course he always would. He would, his horse would come by and save him, or he would jump off a cliff into the water and swim away, or he'd always had some way to be rescued from the predicament that he was in. And there were serials of the westerns, of the cowboys having problems. There were serials of the early days of the idea of spaceman, like Buck Rogers and the different ones of those. And then there was the serials on the Dick Tracy, who was the detective type things, and those would continue every Saturday, so you never wanted to miss a Saturday, so you wouldn't miss what was going on in them. Then, as well as the cartoons and the serial, they would also have a couple of feature films. So you could be in, you could go to the movie on a Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and you wouldn't get out till 6 o'clock with all that went on. So I think it was a real good babysitting situation for the folks to let us go to those movies, and for 15 or 20 cents, why, we could go all afternoon. And I started when I was 9, like I say, earning my money that I would try to earn enough to go each week and be able to do what I wanted to do with my own money. I'll tell one experience that happened, however, when I was about 10 years old. For some reason, I hadn't made that much money that week, or else I had already spent it. So when I got to the just about ready to go to the movie, I only had 15 cents. And I thought, well, that'll buy me the ticket to the movie, and it'll also buy me a cold drink, but I'd really like a candy bar. And so two of us decided that we would go to the little 5 and 10 cent store, or kind of like a drugstore type of thing that was close by the theater. And they had the candy bars in open trays like they do in the grocery stores and so on. So we very carefully worked our way around, and we were each going to steal a candy bar so that we could have that as well at the movie. And as I took the candy bar, and I was just really scared. I was really frightened. This was an experience I don't know how I had gotten myself into it, but I did, and had nobody to blame but me. But I picked up the candy bar, and I put it in the pocket of my jacket real quick, and I turned around to leave, and here was a guy standing right behind me, and I swear to this day that guy had to be 10 feet tall. I mean, he was the biggest guy I've ever seen. He probably was just a very normal man, but to me, he looked like a giant. And he looked at me, and I looked up, and I didn't know what to say, and he looked me straight in the eye, and he says, "Are you going to pay for that?" And I looked at him, and I says, "Yes, sir." I went up to the counter in the store, and I took the candy bar out, and I paid him the nickel for it, and went to the movie with the other 10 cents that I had. And so I had the movie and a candy bar, no drink or anything else that day, but I never forgotten that. And I guess I was really fortunate when I think about it afterward, that the first time that I ever really tried to do something that dishonest, I was caught. I was caught so quickly and so severely, and had to pay for my own mistake real quick, that it stuck with me. And I think it helped me all through my life, that whenever there was any kind of a temptation of, well, is this right or wrong, or should I do this or not do this, there really wasn't much of a decision. I could, if that came up, I could see this 10-foot tall guy standing there saying, "Are you going to pay for this?" And I always paid for it. And so I've been always kind of grateful that that happened. Then a little later from that, I think Carlisle started with a paper route where he would deliver the papers on his bicycle, like the paper boy that used to come by our place on 17th. But I went to work for a man who did all of the artwork for the marquees and the entrances to the theaters in town. There were 5 theaters in Boise, and he had a shop underneath the Fox Theater, which was a big one, and in this basement he had this set up, and would do sign painting, because at that time the signs and the brochures and the signs like you see at the entrance into theaters now, that are, you know, in these boxes of showing what the next movie's going to be and things like that. Well, that wasn't being passed around in the circuit. If there was a movie on, the sign painter had to make up signs saying what this movie was or what the movie coming next week was, and make the whole signs. And he had the whole process there in the basement to do silk screening work, and he could do four color silk screens. I'm not sure how many who listen to this will be familiar with what silk screening is, but you take a literally what is a silk screen type of thing. It's a very fine mesh porous screen, and you, with a razor blade or a very sharp knife, you cut out the areas that you want a particular color or a particular part of the wording or the picture to go through. And you mount those screens on frames, then you take the poster and you lay it out flat. You lay the silk screen over it, and if you want a red color in part of the wording or part of the picture, you put the red color on, and with a squeegee, you would squeegee this paint back and forth on the silk screen, which it would go through like through a stencil, and mark that part of the screen, and then you'd move on to the next, depending on how many of those you're going to do. You'd just do as many posters with that one as you needed, and then as soon as they're dry, you would then take the next one, which was a different stencil, a different silk screen, and you'd lay it over the picture, and with a different color, you would go to the next one. And anyway, he was set up to handle four colors like that, so we could do a big poster with pictures and writing and the names and everything on it, and come out in four colors. It was a very interesting process to me to learn about that. I went there when I was about 14, the year before we moved, and worked for him all summer. And then as soon as school started, then I'd go down and work after school also with him. And as well as making the signs, then we also had to take them around to each of the theaters and put them up and mount them. One of the times that sticks in my mind that was probably the biggest project we did was a movie called China Seas. It was with Clark Gable and Spencer Tracy, and it was one of the swashbuckling type of, you know, they were on the high seas, and it was a real adventuresome movie, and a very expensive movie to produce, and the movie companies wanted it very heavily publicized, and they wanted to sell lots of tickets, literally. They suggested that the whole front of the theater be designed. Not only just some posters, but big cutout work on sheets of almost like masonite or pressed paper sheets that we could cut out in the shape of waves, and then cut out a big ship that was on part of it, and then the profiles of Clark Gable and Spencer Tracy and the back, you know, as backdrops to them. And so we worked on the whole front of the theater. We had everything pre-made downstairs that we'd made in the shop, and then we went up and mounted them all over. So the whole marquee and the whole front of the theater was all covered with all of these designed pieces that we had made. That was the biggest project I had ever been involved with, and probably one of the biggest ones that the man I worked for had been involved with, and it was quite an adventure to do that. Another issue to working like that was, which was real great, was the fact that I got to see all the movies for free. We were in the basement, and if I wanted to see a movie in the theater where our shop was, all I had to do was just go up the back stairs, and I'd come out behind the stage and out into the audience and have a seat. And then also, because of the connection that he did the sign work for all the other theaters as well, why, he would get passes to all the other theaters, and he would give me passes to them because he'd get more than he could ever use, and and I would get enough so that sometimes I could take the whole family and go to movies with the passes that I would get. And I enjoyed that work. It was real interesting. It was a real challenge. It was really my first experience, I guess, with commercial art, and to see what could be done and what was being done in an area that I had no knowledge of before. I tried that. So I worked for him up until the time we left Boise and moved to Brigham City. Those are just a few of the reminiscent things back in the time of Boise, although I've brought us up to moving, and so I'll continue on now from the time after we moved to Brigham City. I'm sure you soon will notice that this tape isn't real consistent all the way through as far as the chronology of my life, but when things occur to me, and I'm trying to do this just from bringing thoughts out, well then whenever I think of them, I'll put them in the tape. And this thought occurred to me as I was thinking about the fact that the first money I earned was when I was 9 years old, and usually used it for the movies and so on that I talked about. But the first thing I did buy when I had earned my own money, I went down and bought a little saw and a hammer. And those two items were so choice to me that I could start to try to do some things and build things on my own. I guess it should have told me something about what my life was going to be, that would be one of the biggest loves of my life, is to be able to build things. But as Jeannie kids me about it, and so do some of the children kid me about the fact that I never throw anything away. But I still have that saw and hammer that I bought when I was 9 years old. The handle has been broken off the hammer, but I have the hammer head, but I have the saw intact as it was. And the other way that I earned some money along about that time too, that I learned a bitter lesson on, was when I was around 10, I guess, there was an ad in a magazine that said that you could become independently wealthy by selling their perfume. And you could be as big a entrepreneur and a self-businessman and all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure what the words they used, but if you sent and bought so many bottles of this perfume for 60 cents a bottle, and they sold for $1 a bottle, so you would make 40 cents every time you sold a bottle of the perfume. So I sent and bought 10 bottles of the perfume, and started selling them, and sold the first five, so all of a sudden I had $5 in my pocket, which I was independently wealthy at that time. $5 was big money. I wasn't smart enough to realize that $5 was not mine yet, because I still owed $6 for the perfume. But I guess to show off, which I probably still do in my life, I went out and treated all my friends to ice cream sundaes and milkshakes on the one Saturday when we went to the movie, as well as going to the movie and having the popcorn and so on. I treated all of these friends and was really a big shot. And then all of a sudden realized, well, the money's all gone. I actually even spent more than I would have made in profit, and now I've got to pay people for the perfume. I owe them $6, and of course started immediately getting letters from them that I owed the money. So I sold the remaining five bottles of perfume and raised $5 more. Then I had to go out and sell newspapers like crazy in order to raise the other dollar to pay them off. And I guess again that was just a good lesson for me. I guess it taught me that you don't spend the profit until you've made the profit, and you have to operate a business on a profitable basis before you can figure that there's any profit to it. And so I learned that kind of the hard way at a pretty early age. Maybe these types of lessons helped me through my life, because I was always very conservative with money to a degree. I would spend money when I had it, but I was also very careful about how I spent it, and I never would spend it unless I did have it. I've tried to still do that. I still to this day will not go out and buy something that I can't pay for, that I have accumulated the money first before I go buy something. I've paid cash for all the cars we've ever bought, for the furniture we've bought, for the appliances we've bought. I have carried mortgage on the homes that we've bought, but I've usually had a backup of some sort so that in case there was a problem, I still could pay off the mortgage and we wouldn't lose everything, we wouldn't be in trouble. I've nearly always backed myself in that way, even though we do carry first mortgage on the home. But we don't owe money on anything else, and never have, and hope we never will. Just one thing that is a real strong thing with me, and I guess I learned it from lessons like that early in my life. I said when I first started recording this that I would probably skip around a little bit, because I'm doing this from memory, most of it, and when I think of things that happened, then I'll try to tell about them. So I have us moving to Brigham City, but I'd like to go back and talk about some of the things that happened that were interesting experiences to me during our time in Boise. As I said earlier, we went to Boise when I started the second grade, and I went through school from the second grade up till the start of the second year in high school in Boise. So that period of time was through quite a bit of the formative years in my life, and had some interesting experiences. I mentioned earlier that I had started to play the violin when I was about 10 and took music lessons. I became pretty good on it by the time I was about 12 or 13, and would be invited to play at special programs at the church, and played in sacrament meeting quite a few times, and played at different functions around the town on different kinds of programs. One that was interesting to me was we were invited to go out and play for the prisoners at the Idaho State Penitentiary, which was just outside of the town of Boise. And that was a real interesting experience for me. We went out, and they had sort of a big hall. It was probably where they ate dinner or something, and we put on a performance and played for the prisoners in this hall. And we went out there two or three different times and put on performances for them. So I saw the feeling of, well, it's hard to describe exactly, but there was always this feeling that they were very depressed in a way because of being locked up and for various reasons, and I'm sure they all were. It was justified that they were locked up, but it was a weird feeling to see all of these men being incarcerated for whatever their crimes had been. I also played in the school orchestras, and they were comparatively small groups, you know, like in a grade school situation. And when I started high school, I also started and played in the orchestra there at the high school. And as I said earlier, I had my own little orchestra, and we played at special dances and special occasions. And some of the members of that little orchestra I had when we first started, Don Sprague played the clarinet and saxophone, and David Quarles played the drums, and Jimmy Sales played the piano, and then there was another violinist besides me. I played the violin, and also Ted Arthur played the violin, and then there were some others that we had, but I can't remember the other names. One of the reasons I brought out the fact of the names is because just about 2 years ago, this is now August of 1994, so sometime in about 1992, we were up at one of the social events, either a wedding or a reception or a funeral or something up in Lake Arrowhead, where we had lived, and there was a couple assigned to the Lake Arrowhead ward as the missionary couple were out in on their mission, and I was introduced to them, and when we were introduced to the couple, why, he said, yeah, he says, I remember Lumen. He says, I used to play in his dance band when we were in Boise, and it was Ted Arthur, and hadn't seen him since we left there in 1935. And he since had, they had moved to Salt Lake City years ago, and he married, and he'd been in the banking business there in Salt Lake. So it's a strange coincidence that we run into people like that every once in a while. Because of playing the violin, whether this was an excuse, whether Mother helped me to use that as an excuse, or whether I was just lazy, I really didn't participate in a lot of sports too much. She was always worried that if I played baseball or something like that, I would hurt my hands and not be able to play the violin. So that was her concern, and mine may have been that I just wasn't that ambitious. I did enjoy playing some tennis. I enjoyed running. I was a pretty good runner, although I never did go out for track. Probably the sport I enjoyed the most was swimming. My dad had taught me how to swim, as he did all of us kids. He was a good swimmer, and he enjoyed swimming. When we were there in Boise, there was a big indoor swimming pool. I don't know whether it was owned by the city or whether it was a private enterprise, but it was a commercial type of a swimming pool where the public were invited. You went and just paid your fee and went in, and you could swim. It was an Olympic-sized pool, and it had all of the, on the one end, it had all the different heights of diving boards, and then in the corner of it, it had a big rock formation built up that had the platforms, the diving platforms at different heights, all the way up to, I think it had the 10-meter board on it, and they were not springboards, they were just the stationary. And so us kids, when we were there, you went inside of this rock thing and climbed the stairs and went up to whatever height that you wanted to go, and that used to be our big challenge to see who had the courage to go clear to the top and jump off the top and into the water, which was quite a long jump for little kids. We weren't real little. We were in our from 10 to 10 years old and 12 and along in that age. One experience or one recollection I have of a story, which really isn't wasn't my experience, but when we first went to Boise, well, I would have only been like 5 or 6 years old, so that would have put Carlisle at 3 to 4 years old, probably around 4. And apparently they went to the it was called the Natatorium. They went out there to swim, and Mother would go in swimming, but she was a little bit like Jeannie has always been, that she enjoyed the water to a degree, but it wasn't worth the effort to have to get dressed and undressed and so on to go in. And the same way, Jeannie has always said, well, she wasn't a very good swimmer, but she is a good swimmer. I have seen her swim and know that she is. And I think this same thing occurred with my mother, because they always said, well, she really didn't swim that much. And Dad would tell about this story of that when they first went there, that they were in the pool, and apparently the little kids, probably Carlisle, as being the baby, was on the side, and he fell into the water, and Dad took off across the pool as fast as he could to get over to get him out of the water, because he was too young to swim. And Mother beat him there. She swam faster than he did and got to the baby before my dad did. And so always from then on, he would say, well, to Mother, he'd say, don't tell me you can't swim. You swim faster than I do. And we saw kind of a similar situation happen here just a few months ago here, while we're living here on James Court in Riverside, and we have a swimming pool, and there's a spa connected to it in the back corner, and Diane and some other, I'm not sure whether it was members of the family or other ladies who were back there, and they had their children in the pool. And the spa is they're like steps or seats going down into it. And Monica, her little three-year-old, was playing in the edge of it. And she stepped off from the step into the deeper water. Diane was about 6 months pregnant with her latest baby. And she came off, she was dressed, she wasn't in a swimming suit. She came off off of her chair and was into that spa and had the baby up and out of the water before any of the rest of us even had the reaction to move. And I was just amazed at how that mother's